KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
You know, I was really kind of hoping we wouldn't have any elections until March, but no such luck. In fact, there is a runoff, or a number of runoffs, depending on your election precinct. December 11th, early voting. Now, this is Harris County. I can't speak for adjacent counties, although you can go to my webpage and find your election link. In any case, early voting starts November 29th. The last day of early voting is December 7th, ironically Pearl Harbor Day. And remember, go out and vote. Local elections are actually much more important to you than national elections. They all matter, but it's like, don't blow off the local elections. Things like your education boards and your mayors and your city council people, these are the people that directly affect your lives. So make sure you go out and vote, and make sure your friends go out and vote. Okay, if you're familiar with the River Oaks Theater, you know it's gone through a lot of lean times, and it is currently closed. But according to communityimpact.com, the public is invited on November 20th to a birthday party for the River Oaks Theater. Although it may be closed for the time being, the River Oaks Theater and its illustrious history in the city of Houston will still be celebrated when the theater turns 83 years old on November 20th, and the public is invited to help celebrate.
Stop.
The party.
You didn't start the clock.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, it's not updating for me.
Well, that's your problem. Yeah, you stopped me at 147, roughly. Maybe
okay,
146.
So, can you... Did you click into the window? Is it, like, live?
Well, if you can see it, it should be live.
I can see it.
I can I can leave the timer where it is, unshare it, and share it.
Yeah, I think you should do that.
Okay, let's try. In any case, we're at 147, so just scribble a note in case we have to allow for that.
Yeah.
Okay, stop sharing. Okay, by any chance, did your screen go blank?
It's shifted back to your face. Your profile picture.
That sounds really odd. Okay. All right, so start sharing, click to the page, and how about now?
Yeah, it's updated now.
Okay.
Can you move the mouse? Yes, I'm seeing the mouse move around. Okay.
Okay.
So hopefully that'll be fixed, and I'll be able to just, you know. It's all early right. enough that it shouldn't be too much of a problem in editing. Okay.
Okay. I think that I was just starting to read B.
Yes. I finished A. Yeah, you finished
Good
A.
Good thinking on your part.
Yeah.
Okay. So, 3, 2. Wait a minute. This will let me swallow.
Mm-hmm.
All right. 3, 2, 1. The party is being organized by the Friends of River Oaks Theater, a group formed after the theater was closed during the coronavirus pandemic to fight to keep it from being demolished. The event will run from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at 2009 West Gray, Houston. Prior to the event, Friends of River Oaks Theater solicited feedback from the public for film clips from movies people saw at the theater that left an impression on them. Those clips will be compiled into a clip reel and projected at the party from the Houston History Bus, said Cynthia Neely, one of several co-founders of Friends of River Oaks Theater. Houston City Council member Abby Kamen is also expected to make a proclamation recognizing the theater's birthday. The fate of the theater is still up in the air, with owner Kimco Realty negotiating with possible future tenants. Friends of River Oaks Theater is among the groups vying for the lease and has created a business plan that has been passed on to Kimco, Neely said. We have complete faith in our ability to run and operate the theater as a nonprofit, she said. It has the potential to be magnificent, to return to what we want it to be, plus the addition of live art events. Above all else, Neely said, the group's goal is to preserve the building and its use as a movie theater. Even if they do not get the lease, she said, the group, which operates as a nonprofit and is in the process of getting its official designation, would continue to work to help make the theater a success however it can. Since the theater remains closed, the event will take place outside, behind the theater. Guests are encouraged to patronize nearby businesses in the River Oaks District for food and beverages, Neely said. Learn more about Friends of River Oaks Theater by going to the link that's both in the article and which I've included on the webpage post on thinkwingradio.com for today's show. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, last that I knew about the River Oaks Theater was what we covered a while back on one of our previous shows. So, you know, I'm glad that the theater still has a chance. You know, there's not many indie movie theaters left, so I'd like to pay it a visit someday, hopefully in working order.
It's a really neat theater. I went there before they turned it into a duplex. You know, it was old, it was worn, it was kind of really fun. And they turned it into a duplex, and they basically made the balcony into a separate theater. I think that the feel of the theater suffered from that. So, you know, it's a real problem. How do you make profit from a small old theater in the age of multiplexes and only run one movie at a time? I think that running it as a nonprofit, it used to be owned by Landmark Theaters.
Right.
I think running it as a nonprofit is definitely a step in the right direction. I actually think maybe that's the way that news organizations should go if they want to survive. I would also say that using it as perhaps a community theater, also using it as a music venue, I think doing these kinds of multiple functions is a potentially viable business model for keeping it in working order. I mean, it worked for Rockefellers. Yeah. You know, Rockefellers used to be a bank. And they kept Rockefellers going as a live music venue, my God, forever. I think it may still be doing shows and stuff. Okay, next is a little brief piece. This is from click2houston.com. Just the title of the article was a little confusing to me. Should you start taking tolls again? Now, when you hear that title, it's like, okay, are they saying you should like apply to the toll road authority to take tolls, or they haven't been taking tolls on the toll roads and now they should? Very weird phraseology. What it actually means is, should you start taking toll roads again? Anyway, while we may not be quite at pre-pandemic volumes during peak morning and afternoon commute times, we're getting closer as the weeks and months pass, and overall volumes are trending in line with what we saw in 2019. If you're wondering if it's time to start taking the tolls, i.e. toll roads, well, if you live in the Woodlands or Spring, it may not be a bad idea to start using the Hardy Toll Road. On any given day, the Hardy Toll Road can save you up to 10 minutes on your drive into downtown Houston. Now, you know, this isn't normally a story I would cover. Of course, many stories aren't, except that I feel there's a moral here. It's an example of casual toll road elitism. I don't know what the current toll is on the Hardy going from like the Woodlands or Spring all the way into downtown, but it's got to be a couple, $3-4 by now. I remember ages ago it was $1.50. It can't have gone down. So what this writer is basically saying is, hey, if you want to save 10 minutes maybe each way, and if that's worth several dollars to you each way, each day, then go ahead and take the Hardy toll road and leave I-45 to the peons. I just have this thing about toll roads, especially in Texas, where they've become sort of profligate. Yeah. I just feel like if a community will benefit from a road, it should be built. If they need to sell bonds to build it because it increases productivity in the area and cuts down on air pollution, et cetera, sell bonds and build it. Toll roads basically allow affluent people to go into low traffic environments while forcing less affluent people to either be on the service roads or, you know, take the congested highway. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, when you started talking about this a few shows ago, it really hadn't clicked or hit me at all that toll roads are kind of an elitist concept, because, you know, I am one of the people, one of the myriad of people who just has an easy tag in their car and doesn't really think about it, you know, and sometimes I'll avoid
it
the toll roads because
free.
Yeah, but sometimes, well, for me it is because my mom pays for it.
Yeah, I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, I'll admit that. I'm 23 and I still have my mom paying for my car.
But
you know?
You're not living in the basement, so good on you.
Yeah, and I pay for my own gas, so there's that. But, you know, for me, effectively, it is free. But she will sometimes ask me not to take the toll road because she doesn't want to pay the tolls. You know, and so, like, it is very normalized to me. And I think it's very normalized for a lot of people, but that's for people who can afford it, who don't have to really think about it. But you're right. When you do think about it, it is kind of a weird concept, because the idea of public infrastructure is that it's public and that everybody uses it and everybody benefits from it and everybody contributes to its upkeep. So, you know, it's not the most pressing issue that we face in our modern society, but I would welcome toll roads becoming free. Absolutely.
Well, you know, there was a time when they were supposed to.
Yeah.
That the sales pitch was, well, when we pay off the bonds, they'll become free.
Mm.
Do you know the only toll road ever in the United States that did that?
No.
The Dallas-Fort Worth Tollway.
Really?
It was a toll road. They paid off the bonds and they took off the tolls.
How
only toll road. Now, there is sort of a tangential exception in Long Island, New York, where there used to be a toll road on the Southern State Parkway, mm-hmm. where you would get to a certain point and it would be 25 cents. Now I'm talking like 1973, right?
Yeah.
The AAA in New York fought this toll for years and years. And finally, they came up with evidence that the toll they were collecting was just enough to pay for collecting the toll.
Huh.
So it was essentially a make work project.
Yeah.
So at that point, eventually that toll was taken down.
Mm.
Yeah, just tolls.
Yeah.
You know, don't... public infrastructure, man. It's like you say, yeah. It should be public.
It should be public.
Okay, pardon me. Next one is from communityimpact.com. Montgomery County to return over $7 million in emergency rental assistance funds, or ERA funds, to the U.S. Treasury. Montgomery County will return $7.1 million to the U.S. Treasury after federal data showed the county had distributed less than 30% of its aid. The county has received $18.1 million in ERA funding since December 2020, according to the U.S. Treasury Department and county documents. County Judge Mark Keough said in an email to Community Impact newspaper that he could not provide a breakdown of how much aid was expended, because I'm sure that information doesn't exist. The statewide nonprofit Texas Housers reported Montgomery County used less than 2% of its ERA funding. Keough attributed the lack of spending to a, quote, lack of qualified applicants, duplicative rental assistance programs, and Montgomery County's less strict approach to pandemic restrictions. Okay, just I'm going to divert for a moment. In other words, they were among the counties that preferred people get sick and perhaps die rather than, you know, stay home. I believe, Keough said, that our local policies and approach to not adopting draconian measures during the pandemic have led to much more robust and vibrant economy, which has afforded our residents better opportunities in the job market and thus reduced the need for some of these programs. Texas Housers reported 638 filings in county evictions courts from June to August. Keough said the amount of rental assistance used throughout all county programs was, quote, far less than expected, and that the county would, quote, press awareness of remaining funds. The county also has several programs available through federal community development block grant funds. Now, as an aside, rather than read through all that, I recommend going to the linked article. Again, thinkwingradio.com, go to the show post, click on the link, and all of that information and links are in the article itself. County Commissioner Keough then said he anticipates more residents will use the ERA funding in 2022 when the TEDP and TERA pay funds expire in January of 2022. Montgomery County must use its remaining funds by the end of 2022. So, you know, there is also a comment in here, which I didn't include, that there's like an 80% of the median income threshold. So I'm guessing that Montgomery County, A, is more affluent and there just aren't any poor people without jobs that are getting evicted. And B, I guess that the county took its lead from Dan Patrick and decided that if people die to keep the economy going, that's their legacy to keep America strong.
Yeah.
And I guess they probably didn't push too hard to let people know that these funds were available because he said, we'll push harder, which means that they'll push harder than they did when the funds didn't get used. You know, Texas is one of those weird states that would rather give back public money than spend it.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, honestly, all I hear from Keogh here is excuses for why they haven't helped people in need. I mean, even if Montgomery County itself doesn't have any poor people, you know, the surrounding counties like undoubtedly do, because when you have a community, an affluent community, like that is supported by a non-affluent, you know, working class, underclass. And so, like, if necessary, you know, I don't know, give that money to the other counties or tell the federal government, hey, we don't need this, but other counties around us do. You know,
there are four counties.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if keeping the county economy open in Montgomery County landed some people in the hospital, which would create even more people who need assistance because hospital bills are expensive.
It may have been good for some funeral homes.
I suppose, you know, that's.
Although we don't have those statistics, that is clearly speculation on my part, you know.
So. Yes, yes. I mean, hopefully that the federal programs, you know, when they return this money that hasn't been used, hopefully federal programs will be able to distribute the $7 million because the county clearly isn't interested in doing that.
Yeah, we'll have to see. You know, I haven't been to Montgomery County in quite a while, but I wonder if they've replaced the Welcome to Montgomery County signs with signs that say Welcome to Montgomery County unless you're poor, turn around. You know, I mean, these days, nothing should surprise me.
Yeah.
I used to say I'm from New York, nothing surprises me. But now that I've been in Texas for about 30 or 40 years, it's like, yeah, there are still some things that surprise me, but the threshold has really gone up.
I'm from Texas, nothing surprises me.
But you spent time in Britain, so there's like that dichotomy in terms of
how. Well, yeah, there's that. Yes, yeah.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2. We can be listened to live online, live on HD2 if you have HD, but then, of course, you know that if you're listening on HD. My recommendation is podcast it, although occasionally there are podcast issues like last week. But you can always go to thinkwingradio.com, go to a show post, and I will always have the show audio there. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links and full articles, or rather two full articles, on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also type keywords into the search bar to find prior shows or prior topics. We're also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. Look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And Andrew?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter as well, at DominateEYE. I don't really use it, but it's there. And spelled the same.
That's
on
an inducement.
I know. But, you know, it's more here to plug my other social media channel, which is spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay, our next story is from CommunityImpact.com on a topic that we've actually discussed a couple of times on the show. Harris County temporarily pauses lawsuit over I-45 expansion in pursuit of negotiations with the Texas Department of Transportation. Harris County will pause its lawsuit against TxDOT over its I-45 expansion project after a unanimous commissioner's court vote on November 15th, but only temporarily while county officials attempt to negotiate with the department. Harris County's lawsuit against TxDOT was announced March 11th amid concerns over the planned $7 billion expansion of I-45, dubbed the North Houston Highway Improvement Project, the NHHIP, which you'll be hearing about, as previously reported by Community Impact newspaper. The lawsuit was not supported by Precinct 3 Commissioner Tom Ramsey, Republican, or Precinct 4 Commissioner Jack Cagle, Republican. Both voted in favor of the temporary stay November 15th, however. Cagle said, as someone who has regularly voted on the two side of 3-2 votes of whether we should go forward with this litigation, I commend the effort to try to negotiate. County Attorney Christian Menefee will negotiate the temporary stay, asking for 30 days to communicate with TxDOT. The stay can be extended another 30 days should the county opt to continue negotiations, according to a November 15 press release from Menefee's office. TxDOT's I-45 project, which would widen parts of the interstate near downtown Houston to Beltway 8, sparked concerns about the effect on residents living in the area. More than 1,000 homes would be displaced by the project, according to Menifee's office. Menifee's press release said, in designing the NHHIP, TxDOT failed to follow federal law and properly consider air quality, flood mitigation, and other impacts on communities, schools, etc., near the segments of the highway that will be widened. During the November 15th special meeting, multiple members of the public spoke in favor of the county's lawsuit and expressed concerns over TxDOT's planned project. Houston resident Aaron Erickson said communities, and mainly communities of color, will be impacted by the expansion. I implore this body to remain constant with its litigation to ensure that the needs of community members are heard over the ones of special interests and power. I'll admit, until the last like couple of years, when I've been reading articles about like some of the shenanigans building the 610 loop and I-45 and I-10, I really was not aware of how it appears that certain neighborhoods seem to be more targeted and certain neighborhoods seem to be more favored. As a matter of fact, when you go down the West Loop 610, there's sort of a jog in that road, and that jog is because one of the shakers and movers, if you will, one of the important business people in Houston owned property that he didn't want divided. So he was able to engineer a wiggle in the West Loop because it's, you know, it's nice if you can do it. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, my take on this is that Harris County should not settle in or out of court until TxDOT writes a plan that follows the law and passes a vote by the affected residents, because their concerns are the ones that really matter here. What worries me about this is that TxDOT and the county are going to come to some sort of negotiated agreement, and it's not going to be put up for a vote by the residents. They're not going to get the chance to, you know, say yes, we are happy with this, or no, we don't want this plan to be put in place. So go back to the negotiating table, and they're just going to, you know, settle on it anyway, either because the court case would take too long, or because it's fallen out of the news, or whatever. And I think that would be the worst case scenario.
Well, I think the good news here is that at least we seem to have advanced to a point where government is recognizing this problem, where disenfranchised populations are getting more attention from local government. This kind of goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of the show, where local government can have a much more immediate impact on your life than the federal or even the state government. I mean, this is a situation where essentially elections matter.
Yeah,
we now have a Democratic majority, a progressive Democratic majority running the commissioner's court. And that's the reason this happened. That's the reason why there was a lawsuit. That's the reason why there is now an effort at a negotiated settlement. And that's the reason these communities are being really seriously considered at all. So elections matter. Elections have consequences. We should never see a 10% turnout. Make sure you vote. This is the kind of reason why. Okay. The next story is from Cron.com. Texas school district wants to ban recordings after Holocaust comments caught on tape. The Texas district, where an administrator was caught on tape suggesting teachers offer books with, quote, opposing views on the Holocaust, now wants to ban secret recordings. One board member also proposed applying the rule to students, according to NBC News. This comes 1 month after NBC News broke the story about the secret audio, which the outlet obtained from a staff member. Carroll Independent School District is in Southlake near Dallas-Fort Worth. According to the reporter Hickson Bowes tweet, the district may ban employees from making unauthorized audio or visual recording of a conversation or meeting pertaining to district business unless the employee making the recording notifies all participants. So the first thing I would note is all meetings pertaining to public business should be recorded. The second thing I would note is they should know they're being recorded so they can try to avoid saying stupid, hateful things. And the third thing I would say is if they're not in the habit of saying stupid, hateful things, they shouldn't mind being secretly recorded, with the caveat that all of us occasionally say stupid, if not hateful things. Andrew?
I understand that perspective, and I agree with parts of it. But what concerns me about this proposed rule change is that it would make it much harder to blow the whistle in that district. And I think because the district has been in the news previously, there is an indicator that, yes, sometimes things happen in this district that need the whistle blown on them. You know, when public officials and official business are involved, I honestly believe that accountability comes before privacy. I don't necessarily think that that's true for private individuals handling, you know, private business, but I think that certainly when you've been entrusted by the public to do a job and you're doing that job, it privacy goes out the window in that specific instance. So
well, I think
for those reasons, I oppose it.
When you're speaking in your role as a public, as a public citizen, I think that in that role, they should be able to record you. You know, Texas is a one-party consent state when it comes to, like, recording telephone conversations.
Yeah.
Should it be different when you're recording individual conversations? Well, I think if they're public individuals speaking in their private capacity, they are entitled to personal privacy.
Fair.
But if you're discussing public policy, either in a public venue or in a venue like, for example, a restaurant, or let's say in somebody's home where you should really be discussing public business in public and not in private, I think it's fair game.
Yeah, absolutely. And the secrecy, I think, is important as well when it's necessary, because like I said, would we have known about this board member's or this administrator's comments about opposing views on the Holocaust, which is just anti-Semitic nonsense, if they hadn't been allowed to make secret recordings, you know, if they had been required to shout them out, essentially?
It's kind of puzzling to contemplate which opposing by the way, I should mention he was citing in this context the Texas legislature's new rule that anything talked about in books that are in school should have opposing viewpoints.
Right.
So there's that little bit of additional information. What I think is troubling is which opposing viewpoints was he potentially referring to, that the Holocaust didn't happen or that it was justified?
Exactly.
Are there either good. Any other opposing viewpoints on the Holocaust?
Right.
Okay. I think we'll do a quick break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can hear the show live online at kpft.org. You can usually podcast it as well. You can also go to archive.kpft.org, where there's all kinds of shows that you can listen to after they've been broadcast. KPFT is Houston's community station, which means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new, honest to gosh, kpft.org webpage and hit the donate button. Pick your favorite show, maybe ours, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between. You see, my computer even thought that was a good idea. And you could get a lovely thank you gift if you qualify. You can also donate by texting the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. You can also help by spreading the word. Word of mouth helps, and it doesn't cost anything. Okay, our next story. Tomball and Magnolia ISDs face challenges with vacant staff positions, from communityimpact.com. Tomball and Magnolia ISDs have been challenged by a number of vacancies this fall in support staff positions such as bus drivers, custodians, and food service technicians to start the 2021-22 academic year. As of October 19th, TISD had 25 open positions for bus drivers, 25 openings for food service workers, and 15 vacancies for custodians. To make up for fewer bus drivers, the district has adjusted routes and schedules, but there have occasionally been late buses in the morning. The district raised the starting pay of bus drivers to $18 per hour at its September 21 Board of Trustees meeting to try to fill the need. The district is looking at other ways to fill other positions, such as contracting a commercial cleaning service to meet the need for custodians. Staffing shortages in TISD are a result of lingering effects from the COVID-19 pandemic. Since the district had slimmed down its staff in areas to reduce costs, it is now playing catch-up to attract and retain enough employees to provide adequate services. You know, because firing is easier than hiring. Laying off, I should say. Firing is different. In MISD, the district is also seeing positions remain vacant. As of November 15th, district officials said there were 14 open bus driver positions to fill, 29 openings for food service technicians, and 13 custodial positions. MISD Superintendent Todd Stevens said the district is trying to alleviate the issue by addressing the salary range for those positions, but doing so makes it difficult to compete with other districts. Stevens said it's a little bit of an arms race there for that wage category. Sometimes it's discretionary dollars that we don't have a lot of to make a difference to find those people. MISD also adjusted its pay for bus drivers to $17.34 an hour when it revised its salaries on August 4th. Despite facing a shortage of drivers, Stevens said MISD has been able to get students to school on time with its bus system. I think we're going to kind of take this directly into a next story. From the Washington Post. This is actually from October 12th, but still relevant and not particularly updated because I looked. A record number of workers are quitting their jobs empowered by new leverage. You've probably heard stories like this, so bear with me. 4.3 million people quit their jobs in August, nearly 3% of the workforce. Those numbers are up from the previous record set in April of about 4 million people quitting, reflecting how the pandemic has continued to jolt workers' mindset about their jobs and their lives. The phenomenon is being driven in part by workers who are less willing to endure inconvenient hours and poor compensation, who are quitting instead to find better opportunities. According to the report, there were 10.4 million job openings in the country at the end of August, down slightly from July's record high, which was adjusted up to 11.1 million, but still a tremendously high number. This gives workers enormous leverage as they look for a better fit. Many businesses say they are finding this new dynamic challenging as they struggle to retain employees and find qualified candidates for open positions. Some businesses have found success by increasing pay and compensation. On the other hand, many workers, particularly those who lost jobs early in the pandemic, might need to find ways to retrain and add skills for new careers. Many workers have decided that low-paying jobs or work that requires a long commute are not desirable, but they could need new skills to fill jobs they desire more. These changes are happening rapidly. The Labor Department data shows that about 892,000 workers in restaurants, bars, and hotels quit in August, as well as 721,000 workers in retail. Yeah, I've been there. An additional 706,000 employees in professional business services and 534,000 workers in healthcare and social assistance also left jobs. Nick Bunker, economist at the job site Indeed, said the numbers were a reflection of the options workers have in the current economic market, with job openings outnumbering unemployed workers and people reevaluating what they want to do. The high level of people quitting their jobs was probably due in large part to people leaving jobs to take other positions, although the data does not specify why people are quitting and where they are ending up. Jennifer Booth quit her information tech job at a national retailer in August after months of working as many as 90 hours a week during the pandemic to help the company revamp its e-commerce system. The final straw came when the chain began moving hundreds of finance and tech jobs overseas, she said. Booth, 48, of Denver, said, to be working as much as humanly possible for all of 2020 and then get told we don't matter, it felt like crap. By July, she had found a new position with comparable pay at an insurance company. 2 months in, she said she feels appreciated. The workplace is more collaborative, and there are more opportunities to move up. Julia Pollack, a labor economist at ZipRecruiter, said the Labor Department data was another indication of how the pandemic has shaken up the labor market. Employers in many industries, including hotels, restaurants, and construction, have complained about the difficulty of hiring workers after the pandemic upended the labor market and made many people less willing to take low-wage jobs. Republican officials in many states sought to address the issue by curtailing federal unemployment benefits over the summer extortion, but those cuts seem to have done little to resolve the issue. In September, the country added just 194,000 jobs, despite the record numbers of openings. Now, I will first say working conditions. I've worked in retail.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a couple of things about working in retail. You're not allowed to sit down. And if you walk around a retail store and look at some of the older employees, they're mostly hobbling.
Yeah.
Because their backs hurt, their hips hurt, they've developed varicose veins from not being able to sit down. If you are seen sitting down on the floor of a retail establishment, you are usually written up. And I will tell you that the last job I had in retail, I think, is what finally did a number on my back. I started to get shooting pains, fiery shooting pains down my legs. And that was pretty much it for me being able to stand around and walk more or less at liberty. And then there are the schedule changes. I remember when I left one retailer for a different, hopefully better job, they gave me an exit interview. And I remember I gave them a very, very short response. Underpaid, overworked, underappreciated. And that's still the case. The fact is that if you want to get a raise or a promotion, you have to switch jobs. They don't appreciate you if you don't try to leave, which puts them in the position of then having to hire someone new, acculturate them to the company, pay them more, which they could have just done to you with all your training and institutional experience that you had from that job. It's just, it's crazy. And I don't understand it. Andrew?
Well, both of these articles that we've read are good news for labor. Undesirable jobs going unfilled will hopefully force employers to make jobs desirable and maybe even make more employee buyouts possible. That'd be nice. Wage competitions are great, too, especially since the minimum wage increase was gutted from the infrastructure bill. I mean, even if it hadn't been, $15 isn't a living wage anymore. There's a living wage calculator from MIT that I'll have a link to on the blog post at thinkingradio.com. That you can check for specific figures for a living wage in your area. So this kind of competition for wages is going beyond what the minimum wage increase would have done. Of course, the downside is it's not in every sector. And, of course, Republicans think they can starve people back into bad jobs. And, of course, it doesn't work.
I will also point out that it was probably a couple of years ago that I read that if the minimum wage had been indexed every year to inflation, 2 years ago, it would have been about $22 an hour.
Yes. And so, on that subject, inflation this year is at 6.2%. So if your pay doesn't go up by at least that much.
On an annualized basis.
On an annualized basis. So if your pay doesn't go up by at least that much around Christmas time, you're getting underpaid. So
now, the reason that we put the school district story and this October story about the Great Resignation together is because there's a news story from Forbes from November 16th. Is the Great Resignation actually a mass retirement? Interesting point of view. The story of the Great Resignation was that the pandemic allowed people to pause long enough to discover the meaning of life. The extra hours of sleep and joy-filled family meals led them to dream of quitting their current jobs to find purpose and passion at work. As the writer says, I wish. Surveys made headlines announcing that 40% of workers planned to quit soon. Proof was the massive 4.3 million Americans leaving their jobs this past August, a record since records began. But is it true? Those numbers sound big, but represent 3% of the workforce, not 40%. The dream hasn't yet headed for the door. Instead, recent research from Goldman Sachs economists offers a completely different take on the now hotly debated tale of spiritual awakening. Fully two-thirds of the folks leaving jobs this past August weren't actually quitting, they were retiring. 1 million more normal, quote-unquote, retirements, an additional 1.5 million opted for early retirement. That's a whole different story. We could applaud a natural generational handover and welcome the increase in jobs and upward salary pressures for young people, but that would be ignoring the divided reality behind the data between well-off knowledge workers and the harsh reality of the long-term unemployed. Some older workers may be sailing off into purposeful third quarters, sitting on comfortable assets and intent on starting a range of enticing opportunities, including launching a new business. 25% of startups are created by over 55s. But over half of U.S. job seekers 55 and older were long-term, i.e. more than 6 months, unemployed. Job losses during the pandemic particularly hit the age extremes, the under 30s and the over 50s. Age is not yet an element of most corporate diversity dimensions. If companies are struggling to find talent in a newly competitive job market where the U.S. has more than 10 million jobs open and the U.K. 1.1 million, they may want to get more mindful of the generational balance of their workforce and tap into a potential longevity dividend. One of the easiest steps to managing retention is to not willingly and unnecessarily lose talent in the first place. You can see the connection to the prior story. This story then talks about three steps to retaining older workers. They're in the article. You can go to my website, thinkingradio.com, click on the link from there and read them. The article then continues, it's ironic in this age of longevity when people pushing past 50 are only arriving at midlife, that's optimistic for some, that so many individuals and companies think they are ripe for retirement. The result is a massive drain of experienced talent. We are likely to regret this loss in the coming years. We may be less likely to reverse it. So there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, the acquisition and loss of institutional knowledge, I think, has been undervalued, forever.
Yeah.
It seems that companies are more willing to hire youngsters with less knowledge, less experience, and require more training, but they get paid half as much.
Mm.
So that's, I guess, on some level, consciously or not, considered a fair trade-off. Also, you know, there's this interesting thing that since the 1950s, life expectancy has gotten a lot longer. So you have literally been in a place where the baby boomer generation, who have really seen the best part of this life extension, has literally been holding back younger generations from advancement and pay increases. So it may in fact be that as boomers like me, I'm an early boomer. I was born in 51. Boomers are considered to have been born up through 64, I believe. So it's going to take a while to kind of, you know, clear out the obstacles. But this is one of those demographic cliffs, right? We've talked about the demographic cliff that China's heading for. Within the next 50 years, their population will have effectively dropped at current estimates from 1.45 billion to about 750 million. That population reduction was not a bug. It was a feature of the one-child policy. Otherwise, their population now might be at 2 billion, and that was something that the leadership at the time, perhaps rightfully, couldn't see a way past. So there's the institutional knowledge question. There's also a question about the value of older workers generally. We talked in the past article about you're never valued until you go or are threatening to go. It's like they don't value you if you're willing to stay. They don't offer you a lot of voluntary merit increases. You sort of have to usually ask for them. Wouldn't it be nice occasionally to feel valued instead of being underpaid, overworked, and underappreciated, feeling appropriately worked, appropriately paid, and genuinely appreciated? Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it sure would. I mean, it's not surprising to me that people aren't just quitting. I will say that the idea that it was just, you know, everybody spent more time with their families because they all worked from home and realized that this was a lot better, not entirely true. The vast majority of workers are service industry workers, I think, in the United States. And so they were still, you know, on the job because they were deemed essential, a lot of them. But they kind of had the opportunity to realize, for a lot of people who hadn't ever really thought about it before, that their jobs suck. You know, they are underpaid, they are overworked, and they are underappreciated. But like I said, it doesn't surprise me.
It should be the mantra of the average worker.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people aren't just quitting. You know, large events like this often have multiple facets, but this is still a huge change because way more people are quitting because their job is bad, and they're realizing, way more people are realizing that their job is bad at the same time than ever before, as far as I know. I also think that some of those retirements, especially some of the early retirements, are also because people are realizing their jobs are bad. So I really think that both the Great Resignation and the Great Retirement are happening. As for older workers, of course, you know, ageism exists and institutional knowledge is lost when a worker retires. Employers should treat every worker better. Turning businesses into co-ops would be a start, or, you know, abolishing the wage system. But certainly older workers should be valued for their experience and they should be treated like people.
I will say something just kind of as a coda to this.
Sure.
I remember when my dad turned 40 and how depressed he was. Because he felt that he was too old to really, you know, if he needed to get a job, he just felt nobody would want to hire him. And I think at the time he was job hunting, if I recall. I mean, I would have been about 9.
I've got a very similar experience, actually, because...
I'm sorry, I was going... I apologize. I kind of got lost. I was trying to remember to say that now, basically, 50 is the new 40.
Mm-hmm.
50 is the new 40, so now it's the 50-year-olds who feel like if they lose their job, they can't get hired.
Right.
I'm sorry, you're going to say you had a similar story from your dad.
Yeah, from my dad, because, you know, back 2019, you know, he got a little farther back. I think it was like 2018, the company he'd worked for like 35, 40 years laid him off. And he needed to find a new job, and he found a new job. But then, like, in less than a year, that company laid him off. And so he was looking for another job. And, you know, I hadn't mentioned this on the show before, but unfortunately, he passed away from cancer right at the start of 2020. And so, and he was near, you know, sort of Social Security age, Medicare, Advantage plan and all that sort of thing. Yeah. The age when they start advertising health supplemental plans to you, you know, over the phone. So, you know, he was up there. And so, and it was just, it was really weird going from my dad always having a stable job throughout my entire childhood to seeing him at that advanced age with all of his knowledge, all of his experience, all of his impressive qualifications, having trouble even getting an interview. And so, yeah, you know, older workers are not valued, and they should be.
So. Yeah, and it's not just an American problem. I mean, you know, in China, because they want to keep the younger generations employed and not rebellious, mm-hmm. they have a fairly young mandatory retirement age for a lot of people, 50, 55 years old.
Mm.
And, you know, even though it's a theoretically socialist country, their retirement benefits are not good. They don't tend to go up with inflation. So my late father-in-law, I think that he was getting the equivalent of like $20 a month in retirement. My mother-in-law, who is still alive, I think she's getting the equivalent of about $8 a month for her retirement, which in China doesn't go very far. We're talking about roughly 6 or 6.5 renminbi per dollar.
Yeah.
And yeah, you have to be earning at least the equivalent of about $15,000 a year to live even passively well in China right now.
Well, I know that like there are a lot of complaints as well about, you know, Social Security in the U.S., you know, is not enough for a lot of older folks who don't have other sources of income. And I know that in the U.K., you know, a couple of years ago, they did a huge overhaul of the Department for Work and Pensions. And so now people are, you know, disability payment is being reduced. Pensions are being reduced, you know, all these sorts of things. Societies in general around the world seems to not be taking care of their older members of their population, if they ever did, you know. So it's just sad. It's just a sad affairs. Yeah.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can hear the show live online at kpft.org, podcast it, or go to archive.kpft.org. Remember that every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on Show Posts and More at the top of the page, find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can type keywords into the search bar, and I do that too. We're also on social media where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. We're on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I'm on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, and Andrew has his active and also his ignored accounts.
Yes, I do. My ignored mostly account is Twitter at DominateEYE, and it mostly just redirects people to my Tumblr, which is spelled the same at dominatei.tumblr.com.
Okay. This may well be our last story because it's a little lengthy. I think it really should have been a major national news story, and I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more coverage. Mm. This is from the Washington Post November 14th. In wake of Bannon indictment, Republicans warn of payback. GOP lawmakers say Democrats, by pursuing contempt charges against a Trump ally, are paving the way for them to go after Biden aides if they retake the House in 2022. Republicans are rallying around former White House advisor Stephen K. Bannon after his indictment on charges of contempt of Congress on Friday, warning that Democrats' efforts to force Bannon to comply with what they say is an unfair subpoena paves the way for them to do the same if they take back the House in 2022. Bannon, like former President Donald Trump, has refused to comply with an order from the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection to turn over records and testify about his actions leading up to the attack. I will point out as an aside, he didn't have to testify against himself. He had to show up, and he chose not to show up.
Mm.
Many GOP leaders, however, are seizing upon Bannon's indictment to contend that Democrats are, quote, weaponizing the Justice Department. Always these guys with projection, warning Democrats that they will go after Biden's aides for unspecified reasons, because that's all they need, if they take back the House majority in next year's midterm elections. I'm editorializing, just know it's not all in the article. For years, Democrats baselessly accused President Trump of weaponizing the DOJ, said Elise Stefanik, representative from New York. in reality is the left that has been weaponizing the DOJ. It's not me, it's you. What is the expression? What you say to me bounces off me like rubber and bounces to you. I know that's not the quote, but it's something
like
that.
Sticks to you like glue, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. And she's the third ranking House Republican, by the way. Representative Jim Jordan suggested that Republicans would seek payback if the GOP regained control of the House, signaling that in challenging the doctrine of executive privilege, Democrats were making it easier for Republicans to force Biden's top advisors to testify before a future GOP Congress. According to Jordan, Joe Biden has eviscerated executive privilege. There are a lot of Republicans eager to hear testimony from Ron Klain and Jake Sullivan when we take back the House. Sullivan is Biden's national security advisor, and Klain is the White House chief of staff. Oddly, I don't think any of them have gone to a dinner given by Vladimir Putin. Democrats argue that the doctrine of executive privilege, intended to shield confidential communication between a president and his advisors, was never meant to apply to the kind of information the committee is now seeking. The panel is exploring conversations between Bannon and Trump that occurred when Bannon held no government position. And committee members say they're interested in interactions related to an insurrectionary attack on the U.S. Capitol, not in talks involving legitimate government business. More broadly, they say that far from being political, the January 6th committee is investigating an effort to overturn a legitimate election, including an attack on Congress that resulted in 5 deaths and injuries to some 140 law enforcement officers. 9 Republicans joined all House Democrats in voting to hold Bannon in contempt last month. But many Republicans are dismissing such distinctions, and Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican Colorado, issued an especially direct payback threat. She said, quote, "Now that Democrats have started these politically motivated indictments for contempt of Congress, I look forward to seeing their reactions when we keep that same energy as we take back the House next year." Stefanik, I believe that's the correct pronunciation, to bolster the contention that Bannon's indictment is politically motivated, pointed out that when congressional Republicans voted to hold Attorney General Eric Holder in 2012 and former IRS official Lois Lerner in 2014 in contempt, the Justice Department under President Barack Obama did not pursue criminal charges against them. I don't know that it said that the Congress then decided to recommend indictment to the Justice Department, so a little different. Even as a handful of Republicans urged former Trump aides to cooperate with the January 6th committee's investigation, most high-profile GOP leaders have quickly turned Bannon's indictment into the latest litmus test for loyalty to the former president. The former president continued his drumbeat of support for Bannon throughout the weekend, saying Sunday, quote, "This country has perhaps never done to anyone what they have done to Steve Bannon, and they are looking to do it to others also," unquote. Bannon himself kept up his characteristically aggressive rhetoric in the hours before news of his indictment broke, declaring on the Friday episode of his podcast, Bannon's War Room, that, quote, "thugs run the New York Times," and boasting that pro-Trump Republicans are taking over all the elections. Yeah, be afraid. "We're taking action," he said, "and that action is we're taking over school boards. We're taking over the Republican Party through the precinct committee strategy. We're taking over all the elections. Suck on this." This is Steve Bannon. Yeah, there's a link to that. Republicans who are challenging Bannon's defiance of the January 6th committee have become targets of attacks by Trump and his supporters. Representative Fred Upton, Republican Michigan, who voted for both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the contempt motion against Bannon, has since received death threats, he said. On CNN's State of the Union Sunday, Upton defended his decision, saying Bannon did not cooperate with the committee in any way and that he would await the panel's next steps. He said former President Trump said early on he did everything totally appropriate. Those were his words. So we have to let the sun shine in, be fully transparent. Andrew, you said that before. And that means get to the truth. Find out exactly what happened. Upton said, if you stonewall Congress, if you refuse to participate in that, all of a sudden you don't really have an equal branch of government trying to get the answers on this. Representative Adam Kinzinger, Republican Illinois, who has been an outspoken critic of Trump and has for months urged his party in vain to distance itself from the former president, over the weekend mocked Trump's threats to primary Republicans who went against his wishes as, quote, the latest dispatch from Worriedville. Kinzinger is one of two Republicans on the January 6th committee, along with Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming. GOP strategist Doug Hay, a Trump critic, warned on Fox News Sunday that Republicans' defense of Bannon could have implications for Congress's oversight authority as an independent branch of government. He said Congress takes these things very seriously, and whether you're talking about a Republican House or a Democratic House, the primacy of Congress and its oversight is paramount. Hay went on, Republicans and Democrats should be able to unify on this. They obviously won't, But if we have a Republican House in the future, they will have no hesitation in holding Democrats in contempt, just as we're seeing right now. So why isn't this a much bigger national story? Republicans claiming alleged executive privilege for alleged discussions of an alleged conspiracy to overthrow the United States government and then threatening revenge for doing that? The Clinton impeachment I see is revenge for Nixon. Pelosi saying in advance that George W. Bush would not be impeached when the Dems took the House in 2006. I see that as an effort to break the revenge cycle, even though he probably should have been impeached. The two Trump impeachments have probably got the Republicans ready to impeach the first Democratic president who gives them a whiff of even a made-up excuse. And now Steve Bannon, even though the Republicans should want to enforce congressional subpoena as much as Democrats, they're fighting enforcement of congressional subpoenas. Andrew?
Well, you know, I'll kind of take us home, I guess, because we are pushing up against the clock here. I mean, I think this wasn't a bigger story because – I mean, I believe Republicans will be as vindictive as they say they will be. I think the Democratic Party doesn't believe them because the Democrats are too familiar with the established way of politics and their place in that way of politics. Republicans increasingly do not care about things like decorum and the status quo. So what baffles me is why so many centrist Democrats still cling to it. You know, I really think that there's large swaths of the Democratic Party that kind of needs to wake up, get out of the way of the people who are trying to achieve something, anything, before the two-party pendulum inevitably swings the other way. You know, if you want to sit there and debate whether this much money is necessary for this bill or if this messaging is too divisive, then try letting the pressure off of the rest of the left, both inside and outside your party, so they can help you keep the Republicans at bay and you can get the time to ask those questions.
I will say in conclusion very briefly that I think this is a generational issue, that the elder Democrats in power, people like my age and older, they went through what I call a political trauma during the 1970s, 1980s. The Republicans made them look weak and anti-defense and anti-American, and they had to adapt or maladapt by trying to become Republican-like, and they felt that was the way to compete. You've got a younger generation in there now. They're more progressive. They don't have living memory of these traumas. And I think you will see over the next several years, this will evolve as people die, as people retire, as people are losing primaries and such. So that's the story. Anyway, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFD HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, dog care for her. And, basically, co-share of responsibilities in many respects with this show, Andrew Ferguson. I hope you found it interesting. I hope you found it informative. And I'll be looking forward to speaking with you next week. Y'all take care.
See you later. It's not too late.
KPFT has been a staple in the Houston area and surrounding communities for over 50 years. With an amazing volunteer staff, we are able to produce exclusive programming that you cannot hear anywhere else. From every genre to the local current affairs programs, our volunteers give 100% to the communities in which we serve. As KPFT continues to evolve, we ask for your input and we ask that you support the arts, music, news, international news, and current affairs that you've come to know and love. With your support, we've been able to grow our programming and serve our communities more now than ever before. As time changes, isn't it good to know that you have a community station that does too? If you have not sent in your contribution to KPFT, now is the perfect time to do just that. Go online to kpft.org. Giving could never be easier. Thank you for your support of Houston's community station for over 50 years. 90.1 KPFT and FM HD1, Houston.
Hello, Houston. This is your forecast for KPFT. For today, expected to be mostly sunny with a high near 80. For tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 67. And for your Thursday, partly sunny with the temperature falling around 62 by 5 p.m. This is your forecast for KPFT.